and welcome once again to Digital Nerdage, the nerd culture podcast. I am Pat. I'm going to be alone for the first part of this. Corey is going to join me later on for a couple segments. But this week, we definitely wanted to talk about a few comics that we had the opportunity to check out before they came out from Alternate Comics. They are a independent, mostly graphic novels and trades publisher. Who does a lot of creator-owned stuff, kind of similar to other companies like Image and Dark Horse, where they're not having their strings pulled. It's all a lot of independent and really cool stuff, and that's kind of stuff we want to look for sure. We don't want to just talk about X-Men and Batman and Superman and Justice League and Avengers. We want to get into some of the stuff that you might not necessarily know about, and honestly, we had the opportunity to check these out. Unfortunately, it's been a while since we've done a podcast because Corey and I have had some lots of things going on, so it's been a lot different than normal. So hopefully we'll be able to get back to getting some stuff out with a little more regularity here shortly in the future. But Corey, like I said, Corey's going to join me in a little bit to talk about EA as a publisher, what they're doing to the video game industry, and then also games that we're looking at that we think really need an HD remake. Come out with a collection, come out with stuff like that. So I'm really looking forward to that and hope you enjoy this episode. So straight into this, we have four different books that I'm going to look at. All of them are from Alternate Comics as the publisher. But like I said, it's all stuff that's done creator-owned, creator, you know, they're just publishing. So the first one I wanted to get into is called Blood for Stone. It's written by Kenton Daniel, and the art is by Shannon Ritchie. I did some digging. It looks like these are kind of some of their first published items. Kenton, the writer, has done a couple of things with Tony and Cleo, which looks like a Cleopatra-based book, and then The Tenth Muse versus Legend of Isis. Both of those are from Blue Water. Honestly, I'm not familiar with the company, but just looking at them, they look kind of like might be something worthwhile checking out, and I might look at them here in the future. But with Blood for Stone, it's a pretty dark story, to be perfectly honest. It's a 5-man Roman legion. They're just done with their assignment in the mountains in the Alps, and they're trying to head back to Rome because most of their unit was killed, and there's 5 of them left. But while they're on their way back home, they're cutting through the mountains, and they run into a small village of just, you know, mountain people. And they are dealing with the loss of a 12-year-old girl from the village. They tell the Romans that they were that the girl was kidnapped by brigands, and you know, because of the terrain of the mountains, they offer help getting through the mountains as repayment if the Romans would go and get back the girl. So obviously, with very few options, the Romans accept, and they take the deal. One of the things is that a slave girl that was from the brigands, from the leader of the brigands, she is left behind. They leave without her, and this girl, you know, somewhat begrudgingly decides that she'll help them out, and she'll lead them to the cave that they're looking for, where the girl would be hidden. But when the Romans get to this cave, they realize that these are not normal brigands. They can tell that there is something much, much darker going on here. And the book really goes into that, and it really comes up with that and shows it. Overall, a good book. There were a couple of things that I was not a big fan of. It's very very inky, very black, in the very spiky art style. It's an interesting art style. It's not bad, but it can get quite overwhelming. It's just straight black. There's no kind of shadows and shading and things like that. It's very heavy-handed, in my opinion. And throughout the book, there is this voiceover going on. In addition to the regular dialogue that's happening in real time, there's kind of a voiceover from, you know, looking back, saying, well, this is what happened. And this voiceover kind of gets a little weird to me. It doesn't exactly hit right on. It's kind of all over the place to me, and I don't feel like it hits home the way it should, and it doesn't really get get the message over that it really needs to. So, but as it goes on, it gets a little easier to follow, but I still think it really needed a little bit of polish on that. Some of these panels are really huge, and I will admit that I got these digitally. I read these on my Kindle with Adobe. So it may have an effect. It may be a little different in print, but I felt like some of the panels, there was so much going on and so many things that were being drawn that you couldn't really tell what was happening or what was important or what exactly you needed to concentrate on to really move the story forward. So it took me a little bit of time to really get through this one. And if I remember correctly, I didn't write it down, but I believe it was right around 90 pages. So it's a good sized graphic novel. But like I said, there is a lot going on in some of these panels, and with the art style, it can get a little overwhelming and a little confusing. There were some really good spots. There are some creatures in it the artist did a really good job of portraying and looking at, and I didn't dislike it, but it wasn't my favorite kind of book. It wasn't something that really grabbed me and drug me in. The story is really slow to start too. It doesn't start ramping up for about a third till about a third of the way into the book, and then you get into a lot more action, a lot more things going on, and a lot more interesting things going on, as opposed to these Romans talking about what happened and making their way to the village and meeting the villagers. Once they get into the cave, it gets a lot better, but that's about 30 pages into the book before that actually happens. And there's a lot of cool things that happen in this cave. I don't want to say cool, but kind of creepy and gory even. There's in not that color would have helped this, but color's expensive for a publisher to use. I don't fault them for not using color. You can do a lot with black and white and a lot with pencils and ink. But I just felt like with the spiky, really kind of almost runny art style for the inks, it really kind of took something away from me. But in addition to that, the story kind of, it follows a pretty normal structure. There's not really a turn or a twist or anything. You kind of see where everything's going. So with that, it kind of takes a little bit away from me, because you just kind of see where the train is headed. It's really right on a set of tracks and follows exactly the kind of story you'd expect it to be once you really get into it and see where the story's going. Kind of even hits a little bit of religion near the end. The kind of final spot where they have to go through this, it actually gets really religious, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. I mean, but I know that it could turn quite a few people off by getting into things like that, and it gets pretty gruesome at times. And like I said, even without the color, some of the gruesomeness comes through. It shines through. So there's a lot of good things about this book, and I don't want to sound like I'm just completely dogging on it, because I did enjoy it once I got through it. But it wasn't my favorite thing that I've seen lately. And so, I mean, when I look at it overall, I gave this 7 out of 10. Eventually, I'm going to come up with a really catchy, cool rating system. But for now, I wanted to get these reviewed. And 7 out of 10 for Blood for Stone. It's got some shortcomings, but there were a lot of things that I really enjoyed. And there were a lot of cool things that it can be built on. And I definitely see a lot of cool stuff with this. In addition to that, another one we did was Anyone But Virginia. Now this is from Jess Eisereiki. I think I will. I couldn't find a pronunciation for it, and if I'm butchering that name, I do apologize. And Zoe Crockett was the artist on that. Now this is actually, there's even a movie kind of based on this character that's in this book. And in fact, it got kickstarted as well. Anyone but Virginia, it's the question, what happens when a superhero has to go home when no one knows about her secret life? Virginia is a government created superhero called Volcano Girl. A schoolmate tracks her down as Virginia Patterson to invite her to the 10-year school reunion. Virginia has not been home or spoken to her friends in 6 years. How could she keep her secret while she goes home? Now, one of the things about that is Virginia was actually elected vice president of her class back in high school. So anyone who's out of high school or you know, been through that, the class president and the class vice president are, that's kind of their duties from senior year. It's their duty to kind of set up those reunions after a while. So it kind of freaks Virginia out a little bit that she's found, because she's not supposed to, and no one's supposed to know about her, no one's supposed to know anything. And it really comes home to roost, and she kind of freaks her out and gets her going. So this one was drawn absolutely amazingly. I loved this. It's all pencils. It's, you know, it just absolutely amazing shading. Everything, very realistic looking characters. The expressive, the expressions on their faces were so well done. I cannot rave about this enough. Again, it's black and white, so you really have to work something different to you know, not have color and still be able to portray some things. So it's really great. A great story. Really, you know, everyone can relate to, you know, going back to high school and having secrets. Going back home and having secrets. You don't always share everything with the friends you had in high school, because they might not be your friends as like they were in high school. And she's got a huge secret to hide. So it really becomes something different. She, you know, runs into some old friends. Runs into one of the boys that really had a crush on her, and she kind of dated for a while. So, and there's some interesting things there. Her best friend, who wasn't necessarily all that fond of her being a vice president, kind of there's some interesting dynamic there. And unfortunately, she finds out that she had died after going back to Israel to serve in the Israeli army. So that really hits home for Virginia, and it really takes a lot out of her, and really makes it makes her realize that she shouldn't have been gone so long. There's a great moment at the end, and I won't, you know, spoil too much of it, because but there is it's a really cool moment at the end. It's kind of been done before, but I really enjoyed the fact that they did it, and it really it was fun, and it was a great ending to that story. You know, and there's a lot of emotion to this story. There's a lot of things going on, saying, you know, what happens when you go home again? What is this? What is that? You know, you don't always know exactly how you're going to react when you've been gone that long. She hadn't even seen her parents in years. So it's really her kid sister that she has, who discovers her secret identity and finds all these things out, and that adds another dynamic to it, because now you're dealing with a younger sister who's a reporter for the school paper. So it's there's a lot of fun going on, a lot of laughs, but a lot of cool, like, really emotional type stuff that's going on. And like I said, I really loved this. I would absolutely recommend this for anyone. It's actually $2.99 on Comixology for the digital version, and I cannot recommend it enough. I gave this a 10 out of 10 because I loved this. Everything about this hit the right notes for me and really hammered everything home. So I this is a must-buy for me, and I really, really recommend it for everybody else. If you like seeing the different side of a superhero story, not necessarily the everything's going right and everything's kind of exactly what you'd expect for a superhero, check this one out, anyone but Virginia, because it really, really is a lot of fun of a story. And I think anyone who has gone back to high school reunion will really, really get a kick out of this story. Next up was actually a collection of stories. It was called Horror in the West. Lots of different stories. I didn't catch how many stories were actually in there. There were a lot. I think it was upwards of 10. But they're all just a couple of pages, you know, 3, 5, 7 pages. Not a huge amount. And they're all Western horror stories, which pretty, you know, pretty obvious from the name, but, you know, every story has different people. Every story has a different artist, writer. So there's a lot of things going on, a lot of different art styles, a lot of different tones for the writing. Just a collection of really good horror stories. Some of them leave you kind of wanting a little more, which is a good thing, but some of them kind of hit you and just they wrap up cleanly. So it's, you know, you've got that good mix. You never know. This is something that may continue. They may have stuff keep going from some of these. So, and they were really all odd. I mean, each one of them seemed to come out of the left field. It's just some really out there stories. Indian burial ground type stuff. Just zombies. Actually, the first story is an alien invasion where a cowboy actually adopts an alien that landed, and it just takes him over, and it's just a lot of different things that you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of, and I don't think you could ever do as big long arc stories or even a full 22 page comic. So I think you'll get a lot of cool things out of this, and you get a lot of different bite sized chunks that you can really hammer through pretty quickly. And like I said, really had a lot of fun with this. Some of them were, some of them were just a little too far out there. So it just, once in a great while, it would throw me off. But honestly, the best one I loved the most was called The Amulet. It, just a great art style and a really cool story about it. It's something out there about it. Just something rang true, really hit home for me, and I really enjoyed it. So it was a lot of fun. But check this out, Horror in the West. I gave it 8 out of 10. And it was really fun to read through all these different ones. You know, sometimes it took a little while to get through, and I'd have to read through a couple of them a couple times. But overall, I really enjoyed the book and do recommend it. Again, that one just hit stores on October 10th, so that one's still pretty fresh in the mind, and check your local comic store for that. If not, once again, check their Comixology, check other digital sources for Alterna. I'm really finding a lot of things from them that I'm really enjoying, and you know, I think everyone would. The last one I'm going to hit, and the last one I did was... This one has a really long title, so it's called The End is Totally Nigh. Issue 1, Valley of the Shadow of Really Scary Grade Schoolers, from Kay Barrett and Vinny Rico. Vinny is the penciler, and Kay Barrett is the writer. And this is the first part of a story where grade schoolers are possessed by demons trying to bring the devil to Earth. A mysterious girl named Jane, brought in by demon hunters to assist in the exorcism of the demons. Demons say they know something about Jane that nobody else knows. And I really had a ton of fun with this one. There's so many things to say that I can't even really get my head around them. Once again, really good art, great story, and I really can't wait for the next issue of this. I'm definitely going to be checking this one out over and over again, because I had just an absolute ton of fun. Because you wouldn't necessarily expect it. These are all like fifth graders, fourth or fifth graders, that are all possessed. It's around 10 of them, and they're all possessed by demons. And there's something about this girl, Jane, that they know that they're not willing to share. But some of the demon hunters had worked with her before, and she had one of the fastest exorcisms that they'd ever seen. So there's definitely some mysterious stuff going on here. Once again, a little bit of religious overtones, but it's not as heavy as I saw in Blood for Stone, so I don't really think it'll turn anybody off or really affect anybody's opinion of this. So I don't have a problem with it, and I really don't think anyone will. But it was just... this one, for being a somewhat scary story, kind of a horror story... it really had a lot of cool moments, and the whole thing pretty much takes place in school, so it's not anything really crazy going on in the exteriors and different places. So it really concentrates on the story and doesn't worry too much about all the other things. It really wants to make sure that it's really introducing everything about this, and it leaves you just absolutely wanting more, and I can't wait for that. So I will be definitely looking for that, and possibly even putting that on my pull list at my local comic book store. So so check out these four books, and the end is totally nigh. I gave 9 out of 10. Nothing really to say that was nagging at me to bring the score a little bit down, it was a ton of fun, a lot of good stuff in it, but just not as great. And a lot of it had to do with comparing it to anyone but Virginia. So that really, but I would recommend all four of these books to anybody. Blood for Stone, which was scored as a 7 out of 10. Anyone but Virginia gets the perfect score of 10 out of 10. Horror in the West was an 8 out of 10, and The End is Totally 9 out of 10. All these are from Alterna Comics. Like I said, alternacomics.com. They will point you in the direction to get these books. Get these books ordered at your local comic shop. Get them digitally through Comixology or other digital distributors. But also, in addition to that, one of the things that I wanted to talk about from Alterna was one of their brand new things that's coming out and is actually drawn by someone I met at the Cherry Capital Con here in Traverse City, which is The Secret Adventures of Houdini, drawn by Sean Von Gorman and written by Todd Hunt. It's a pretty cool looking item. If you like Houdini, I think this is really going to give you a cool, different take on it. The synopsis is, after years of debunking false spiritualists, Harry Houdini is suddenly inducted into a world which unceasingly challenges his every belief. Escape with Houdini into a world of magic and sorcery as we witness his greatest metamorphosis from stage magician to hero. These are the untold stories of the final years of Harry Houdini's life. I, for one, am really excited for this. I have seen Sean in action. I have seen the work he does at cons and things like that, and just he's an all-around good guy, and I really am stoked to see this. So, I mean, check out at alternacomics.com. Check this out. They do have it right on the face page of the front page of their website, and there's a lot of cool pages that you can check out and see. So there's definitely some cool stuff to see on this and check out. So, really, really take a risk on it. This is going to be the first book of a series, so it's definitely something to look at, and maybe get out of your comfort zone. Even if you're not a huge fan of magic or a huge fan of Harry Houdini, this is something that you could definitely look at for the future and find something that you're not necessarily always looking for. So take a chance. Alternate Comics is a great thing. It's a great company throwing out a lot of cool creator-owned stuff. So that's the kind of stuff I always want to support whenever I can, especially if it tickles my fancy. So I'll definitely be looking for the Secret Adventures of Houdini and looking forward to it. So I hope you do too. So in this segment, we're going to ask the question, is EA the worst video game publishing company ever? Short answer, abso-fucking-lutely. I can't even begin to talk about how terrible this company is, and the fact that they gobble up studios left and right and just hammer them with regulations, hammer them with things to do, and oversee and make sure that the only thing they care about is the bottom line. One of the prime examples of that, and this broke my heart because I looked forward to this game so much in recent memory, is Star Wars The Old Republic. BioWare is pretty much on back channels of saying, we weren't ready to release this game, and they made us. And it's obvious in the product that came out. It's amazing the amount of companies that they brought up or bought up, you know, Maxis, Tiburon, ABC Software, which not necessarily have anything good, but, you know, DreamWorks Interactive, which basically makes sure that every movie game is always going to be garbage, even if it's for kids. I know Corey has had some, has gotten on his soapbox more than a few times about this one, so I'll kind of let him take a little run at this.
EA is a company that will do whatever it takes to milk and ruin anything they get their hands on. I would put them on the same level as Activision. They will take any series they can, and what it comes down to is bottom line. Now, I'm not going to say that EA is on the same level as Activision for that, because Activision I will view as the absolute worst company for milking a franchise. EA has shown recent improvements in the last few years on some things, or so I had hoped. Will I say that they're the worst company out there? No, absolutely not. If EA was the worst company, they wouldn't still be in business. Are they one of the most evil? Absolutely. You look at good companies like Mythic. Mythic was the first one in my mind that really struck a chord with me, because they took something like Warhammer. Like, Warhammer should have been a great game, and in some ways it was. But there was a lot of failures there, and I feel a lot of that was out of Mythic's hands. They were rushed along in their production, which I know it might not have seemed like that, because Warhammer took a while to come out. But MMOs take a while. They shouldn't be released till they're ready.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, it was released before it was ready. And you see that with, like you said, Star Wars The Old Republic. The Old Republic had the best leveling up gameplay I've ever seen. I've never had that much fun leveling up a character before. But the problem is the end of the game had nothing.
Yeah, because, you know, they had so much to do in that game. The amount of voice acting in that game, every quest had voice to it. Everything you did had voice to it. And you know, that alone takes a lot. They did a great job with that game of getting that level up. But then they were said, well, you know, you guys have delayed this 2, 3, 4 times. We need to get this game out. We need to get out now. So now people level up, and then there's nothing to do, and they can't get the stuff to do at the end of the game out fast enough, so people bail in droves. I mean, I can't believe how quickly they went from 1 million to under 500,000. At their peak, I think they hit 1.3, 1.2 million subscribers to the Old Republic. That wasn't even a year ago. They go free to play in like 4 weeks. That's how far they've fallen. One of the other ones that I'm kind of depressed about is DICE. I mean, DICE was a company that guarded their franchise so jealously that the Battlefield name was synonymous with amazing shooters. Bad company? Not so much. Very good game, a lot of fun, but it wasn't the same as Battlefield 1, Battlefield 2, Battlefield 3. Battlefield 2, until Battlefield 3 came out, was still one of a hugely played game because it was so good. Because they took the time. They didn't just pump out sequel after sequel. Well, guess what? Battlefield 4 scheduled for next year. 2-year cycle. Are you kidding me? Did they not learn from the Call of Duty series? 2-year cycles? Don't do it. The Call of Duty series, which is owned by Activision, the other evil genius, they're pumping out one a year, but they switch studios every year, so that's a 2-year cycle, but you're still looking at just... Modern Warfare 3 was a heaping pile of crap. You know.
Most of them will be. They look at stuff that they can mass produce and they can make a profit off of. And I think the big thing that put EA behind that was EA Sports. EA Sports for a long time had some of the worst working conditions in all of game development. And outside of that, you were looking at stuff that was not producing good results. Their sports games, Madden and NCAA specifically, I would say in the last 4 years, have stepped it up leaps and bounds. They've done a great job with those. But you look at their NBA series, which has gone. You look at most of their other sports series aren't even made anymore. FIFA is barely around. Like, it still does okay, but I'd still rather play a lot of the other soccer games that come out.
Actually,
Winning 11 Soccer was amazing.
FIFA actually, amazing enough, outsold Madden last year, which just amazed me.
That doesn't amaze me at all. Soccer is still the most played and most loved sport in the world.
Well, this is
world
in America.
Versus American.
This was in the U.S., not necessarily world sales. This was U.S. sales. It outsold Madden, which was crazy. Their sports games have come back quite a bit, in my opinion. Madden 13, I haven't played it myself yet, but everyone I'm talking to says 13 is just amazing. And it's back to, like, on par with, like, 96 style, you know, comparing it apples to apples within the time frame and stuff. But there's a lot of people raving about it.
If you want a good sports game, look back to stuff that 99 Studios did.
Oh, yeah.
NFL Game Day 98, that's where it was at.
989 Studios games were so good. But I think, you know, and I think where their downfall came was 2K getting into the market. 2K games went in, you know, struck a deal with ESPN, got ESPN in their games, and then said, okay, well, we're going to charge $20 for these games, for sports games. And, you know, it was a great idea. It was a great marketing strategy. It put 2K on the map. But I don't know. I wasn't a fan of that. And I think that kind of was the beginning of the EA going, okay, we need to figure out a way to jam out stuff and make as much money as we can. One of the things I didn't realize is that they have a stake in Ubisoft, which I guess makes sense considering they have been publishing a lot of their stuff, but or some of their side stuff, but it just was really surprising to me that it was there.
It doesn't surprise me, but on the same regard, I wouldn't expect to see that go much further than just a stake in there. I don't think Ubisoft will sell to EA anytime in the near future.
Oh, no, I agree with that. But it just feels like they sit there and they sit out in the wings and they go, okay, let's see. Okay, they've got a decent idea. Let's find a way to screw that up and get the drones to buy as much as they can. And that's what it feels like. This will never change. One of the things that I did want to bring up, EA voted worst company of 2011 by the Consumerists, the Consumerist magazine. They got the golden poo. And you read the response to it, it's just like they don't care. I'm reading actually article from Forbes.com. As the Consumerist Chris Moran notes, three of those companies have already received the award. Speaking of past Golden Poo Award winners, BP took home the Golden Poo last year, AIG won in 2009, and Halliburton was crowned the champ back in our first ever tournament in 2006. A response from EA, and I lost it. EA responded to the Consumerist. They don't say who the person was. We're sure that British Petroleum, AIG, Philip Morris, and Halliburton are all relieved they weren't nominated this year. We're going to continue making award-winning games and services played by more than 300 million people worldwide. It just feels like when their fans and other people, you know, called them out and said, you guys are terrible right now, they just blew it off and said, well, you're still buying, so we don't care. And that's the only way things will ever change is when you affect the bottom line.
It's the old Sony attitude. It was why the PlayStation 3 was so much when it launched. It's why their launch was terrible, because Sony's CEO at the time said, oh, it doesn't matter what price point we put on this, our name's Sony and you'll buy it anyway. It's also another reason why he was forced out of the company.
Right. Another thing I found on CNET, the creator of Minecraft, Marcus Person, back in April or May, EA put a Steam sale up. You know, they put their stuff up on Steam, put a big bundle, you know, 70% off, the EA Indie Bundle. And Marcus kind of flipped out on them, and he's like, this is from his Twitter feed, EA releases an indie bundle. That's not how that works, EA. Stop attempting to ruin anything, you bunch of cynical bastards. You know, and it is. It's kind of like, really? You're going to claim to have indie games at EA? You're the largest, I don't know if they're the largest, but they're one of the largest, and they're definitely considered a major publisher. And they did use, you know, games like Warp, Shank, Deathspark, Gatling Gears, which are kind of indie titles, but you can't claim that title when you're EA, in my opinion.
Yeah, but they're not playing. I'll moderately side with them on that for the sole reason that they're not claiming to be an indie company. They're picking up indie titles and then publishing them. It's the same reason why they bought PopCap. PopCap was so small for so long, and then after PopCap blew up, not just like moderately, but absolutely blew up, they swooped in, threw an okay amount of money at them, and said, okay, we're going to take all your profits now.
Yeah. A $750 million purchase price, but...
Which they've made back hand over fist.
Oh, without question. Without question. I mean, PopCap is... It's gigantic, and well, now even PopCap is going out and buying other companies, because they're still flying, you know... You know, they're still letting them use the name. They're just basically, you know, a sub company, and they bought the creators of Draw Something. I can't think of the name, but Pop or was that Zynga? Help me out here.
Probably Zynga.
Yeah, I think Zynga's actually the one that bought that. I apologize. Yeah, it was. But you know, it's just until people affect their bottom line, nothing is ever going to happen. When people run out and buy the new, you know, Battlefield 3, Medal of Honor, any number of things, as soon as it comes out and they buy millions and millions of copies, nothing's ever going to change. Same thing over at Activision. You know, if everyone just continues to buy the same stuff over it, you know, oh, it's a new Call of Duty. Okay. Yeah, I think the one company that I feel had the most leverage inside the Activision house was Blizzard, and I think after the, you know, epic failure, in my opinion, of Diablo 3, which, whether or not it was their fault or Activision's fault, I'm not sure, and, you know, World of Warcraft is just dropping subscribers like, you know, a prom dress, I don't see them ever having the power to tell Activision to leave us the hell alone and we'll just send you your check ever again.
Maybe. That company's changed so much.
Yeah, I used to feel like Blizzard was one of the companies that you could always count on to make sure that they put out, you know, stuff that was done. And after Diablo 3, I don't feel that anymore. Just Diablo 3, just it felt broken when I picked it up, and it saddened me.
It was a fun game, but it was still missing a bunch, which was unfortunate. But it was the same kind of thing with StarCraft 2. Like, I think StarCraft 2 proved to be a much larger undertaking than they had expected it to be, and when they couldn't finish it all, that's why it's being divided into so many parts, why it's taking so long.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll see the independent, you know, publishers. I feel 2K is still a pretty small publisher, and their partnership with Gearbox is a great thing. And, you know, hopefully we can see some changes happen, and maybe some other smaller publishers will become larger, and people will just continue to buy the amazing stuff that's coming out of some of these guys. I will not take anything away from Ubisoft, even though EA has a stake in them. I think Ubisoft is still doing some great things. And like you said, I don't ever see Ubisoft, you know, caving in and just selling out to EA completely.
Yeah, I just can't see it happening ever.
No, I think they have plenty. They're too many big enough franchises. I think Assassin's Creed could carry them for 20 years. Not that I want to see an Assassin's Creed game coming out every year for 20 years, but I think they've done a good enough job. And you know, nurtured enough of their brands that they can take the time. I mean, Rayman's an Ubisoft title too. That's a great fun game. So hopefully we can see them maybe get rid of that stake that EA has in them and maybe even buy EA. Alright guys, for this segment, we're going to talk about games that we really feel are in dire need of an HD remake. We all have those types of games that we really loved, really have fond memories of, and just always want to keep going and go back to those games from time to time. One of those games for me is Final Fantasy VII. It's a game that I think everyone has great memories of, and I think there's a bit of a market being missed by not going back and recreating some of these games and re-releasing them, because at a discount price, I think you could really package some up and have a great thing with them. So I know that's the first game on my list is Final Fantasy VII to be remade. Square has addressed this before, and they tell us that it will not happen, but I think eventually we'll see something happen. What do you think, Corey?
The fanboy may would like to see that happen, but I can see where Square is going with it, because it creates a dangerous precedent. If they're to remake Final Fantasy VII to an HD remake, you know, yeah, that'd be great. It'd be a good fan service. But then, you know, where's 8? Where's 9? Where's a remake of 10, even though it was kind of already there?
Where's remakes
of 1 through 6 that are in full HD?
10 has actually already been announced, that at least for Europe. Whether or not it's going to actually make it to the States is another story, but I know they announced that a while ago. It hasn't been released to my knowledge, but at least it's been talked about for 10.
Right, but a lot has been talked about within Square. Now, absolute top of my list would be Legend of Legaia. It was a great, awesome RPG from PlayStation 1. PlayStation 2, there was Legaia 2, which was still fun, but wasn't quite what the first one was. But it was just, it was a fantastic RPG, and doing something like that where it was, you know, a one-off game, you're not at the risk of creating a taboo among a series. You're just putting out something quality that fans could enjoy. And realistically, it wouldn't be that hard of an HD remake.
Right. I don't remember where I heard this, but a friend had told me that they're, at least for the PlayStation 2 games, they can convert it into a PS3 game in something like a week, because the code is that close. It takes almost no time, at least on a PlayStation 2 game. I don't know how that is for PlayStation 1 or for any of the other consoles, but if you can really redo a PlayStation 2 game and put it into HD and put in the trophy support and things like that and release it on a PlayStation 3 in a week, and even cross it over for a Vita too, that's the other thing that was talked about. So it's just, there's so many things that you do so well with that.
I agree with that. And there's a lot of possibilities there, but it's when you look back to the older stuff, like in PlayStation 1, PS1 uses an entirely different style of coding than 2 and 3 did. And on the other side of that, if you look at like the Xbox 360, if they want to take any of these games to those platforms, it becomes very difficult because the coding is 100% different.
Right, yeah. There's always going to be that hurdle, but I think you, to be true to the game at the very least, I think you have to stick with the console that it came out on. While I'd like to see some of it come, you know, over to different consoles, you know, because not everybody has the opportunity to have multiple consoles, I think you're going to make more waves and anger some of the fanboys by switching consoles and putting it on multiple consoles than you would by just sticking with a PlayStation game on a PlayStation, Xbox on an Xbox. Now, granted, if they were already multi-system, that's a different story.
Case in point, and exactly why you won't see most of these ever remade. One, a lot of the companies that made these original games are either out of business or were absorbed into a different company. Two, most of them don't view it as a worthwhile venture. If they can't put it onto both platforms at this point for a remake, a lot of them aren't worth it. Now, you see exceptions with, like, we'll say, like, Ratchet and Clank series. They came out with the Ratchet and Clank collections, whatever. But Sony has rights in that. It was a Sony exclusive. It can stay there.
Right, exactly. You're already looking at something that was developed pretty much in-house as it was. So they're not going to jump ship. It'd be like having Mario on Xbox, which it amazes me how many people will actually ask that question. Hey, do they make Mario on Xbox? Ugh. But, you know, some of the other games that I really, really want, and even if they... Some of them, it's not even necessarily that they need to remake them in HD. It's just they need to make them accessible again, because not everybody has access to old Super Nintendos or N64s or PlayStation 1. And, you know, Sony has done a great job with that and their PlayStation 1 classics on the PSN. But I think Nintendo's done a very poor job with it, but their whole online philosophy has been poor. Xbox just doesn't have that much, you know, nostalgic stuff. But, you know, I'd love to see, like, Secret of Mana, Secret of Evermore, those two games, just tons of fun games. Make them into an HD, I'd love it, but at least make it available. And I have not seen that game anywhere other than on emulation sites.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Another huge one that I would love to see remade would be Lunar Silver Star Story. I mean, they've done a million remakes of it so far, but a real HD remake. It already had voice acting. It already had great music. There's a lot of things that are already there. They just need to make the graphics better.
Right, definitely. And that's been a really cool series. I've dabbled in it a little bit. I played a little bit of the PSP version, but I definitely can see the potential of that game. It has an HD, beautiful, full 720, you know, the systems aren't really doing too much 1080 yet, but it'd be just absolutely gorgeous and easily done. I think one of the biggest things is the not necessarily the angering fanboys or anything like that. It's more devoting a studio to something like that, because it probably would take quite a bit of time, even with a game like Lunar, that you're investing 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever you're investing, and you're taking that away from them developing something new IP, a continuation of another game, an existing IP, and you're not positive you're going to make that money back. And I think the companies are afraid of that, and I think they shouldn't be, because I think the demand is out there. The voices are out there saying, hey, we want to see these games. Beyond Good and Evil was a great example of that. They finally went and redid that within the past year or so. Did it HD, and it sold like hotcakes. It was huge, and it was a cult hit. It wasn't even a mainstream hit. It was a game that was just very, you know, bargain bin, grab it out of there and have a ton of fun with it. And I loved that game. It was one of my favorite games, and I loved when they redid it in HD. So it's something. I think the demand is out there. I think the, you know, marketing support is out there. It's just a matter of them being willing to do it.
But the market risk with a lot of this is very tough to look at. Some of the problem you look at, and this is a little bit away from it, but I'll look at, say, mature games on the Wii. That's why Nintendo never really got behind them, because every time they would provide a positive, mature-rated game to go on the Wii, something that was going to be good, it was a great game that should have been a hit, it wasn't. People didn't buy it.
Yeah, but I think that has a lot to do with Nintendo as a babysitter. Somehow Nintendo got that babysitter vibe to them, and it's something that's a whole nother topic and a whole big can of worms that I could go on for ages on. But there's definitely stuff out there that I think Nintendo just, they don't handle their third-party exclusive IPs well enough. They pissed off Squaresoft, and got Final Fantasy jumped over to another console. Granted, it was always there in Japan on the PlayStation, but I just feel like they really dropped the ball with that in America. One of the other games that I really would love to see an HD remake of is Earthbound. And by extension of that, or Mother Zero, which was a game that they promised us for ages and ages and ages. Again, a Nintendo product that they never brought to fruition. And that's not even a mature game. That game was so much fun. And I would, from what I understand, Mother Zero was a lot darker than Earthbound.
Correct.
But I still think there was a place for it. I still think the market was there for it. And for some reason, again, it's Nintendo's fear of alienating the parents. And I think that's where the problem comes in. Sony and Microsoft, very much willing to do it. Very much willing to say, hey, we have stuff for adults. It's not necessarily for the kids. Nintendo, not willing to say that.
Allow me to back up for a second with your statement of Final Fantasy always being on the PlayStation in Japan. Care to elaborate on that?
As far as I can remember, 1 through 5, and one, unless I'm mistaken, I could have swore that Final Fantasy has always been available on the PlayStation since number 1. Was it only available on the Famicom?
They never released any of the previous ones until they did Origins in both countries. The original one, like Final Fantasy, was a Nintendo / Famicom title. And that's how it went with all of them up until like the Super Nintendo and the Super Famicom, respectively. The titles went on through those. It would have still been a Nintendo title when the Nintendo 64 was out. 7 was supposed to be on the 64. Then all the stuff went down between Nintendo and Sony. Sony jumped ship from Nintendo, and then Square's like, all right, we're going to go with Sony because the disc-based media supports what we want to do much better.
Wow. I guess I had that history wrong. I apologize.
I'm Trevor, where you're pulling that from, because the PlayStation didn't come out until 96, 97. I mean, it was a couple years earlier in Japan-ish. But the original Final Fantasy came out in what?
Yeah, what the hell am I thinking?
87?
Yeah, what the hell am I... I'm going to go ahead and smack myself over the head for being an idiot. What am I thinking?
I'd like to take this time to step up on my soapbox, if you will, and apologize to all of our listeners for our last podcast. And there was a very large failure to fact check a lot of things that were discussed.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of did. We started talking kind of out of our butts about Kickstarter. And it's inexcusable. We've got to make sure that we're giving good information. Obviously, Kickstarter does charge 5%. And then Amazon Payments charge another 5% on top of that, sometimes up to 10%. So that alone was a huge failure on us. And obviously, I'm deciding to keep going on my stupidity. I don't know where the hell that came from. Yeah, no, good call. My dates, and it's been a weird day for me today.
Understandable.
I guess my brain is looking at all the Final Fantasy Origins and everything and going, oh yeah, they've just been always on PlayStation. Kind of hard when the first game came out 10 years before that system came out. Hey, Vey. but that's a good call out of the Sony and Nintendo fallout, though. That's another whole cool story that we could get into is and I don't think there's enough true fact out there on that, though, of the fallout between Sony and Nintendo when the Sony PlayStation was supposed to actually be a Nintendo product.
There's plenty of true fact about that. It's a straight-up true story. Sony was contracted by Nintendo to make their disc-based system, or their disc-based attachment, if you will. They didn't trust Sony, however. Sony hadn't ever really looked at the gaming market before. They did plenty of electronics, but gaming wasn't what they cared about. So Nintendo went behind their back and went with Philips, because they thought Philips would be a more reliable company to work with and would make them a better product. Sony was not happy about this, told them to go F themselves after they got double-crossed, and released the system under their title, the Sony PlayStation. And thus continued to bury Nintendo for that entire console generation.
Oh, yeah. There were great things on there was some great stuff on the N64, but nowhere near what could have been and what should have been. I mean, you look back at the original PlayStation, and there's great stuff there. There's, you know, obviously the Final Fantasy, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 was a PlayStation 2, but you look at that stuff, and yeah, it would be interesting to see what the world would be different if Nintendo hadn't screwed up and pissed off Sony.
Same thing could be said if Atari hadn't screwed up and not went with Nintendo.
Well played. Well, that's going to do it for another edition of Digital Nerdage. We hope you enjoyed it this time. Find us always at facebook.com/digitalnerdage and at digitalnerdage on Twitter. We always love to hear back from you guys, good, bad, and different. We've had our struggles. We've had a couple of mishaps, a little bit of stupid information, stupid things we said. We're working on that. We're going to really strive a lot harder to prepare a little better and make sure that we're giving you the best that we can. We really want to make this work. This is kind of my baby, and I don't want to screw this up. And I've kind of been the culprit, especially this episode. I'm not exactly sure how I was thinking about the PlayStation and all that, we hope you keep listening. Next episode, I believe we're going to try and get it together. We may put a different episode together, especially considering I'm recording this last section on the 3rd of November. So we just heard about LucasArts being bought out by Disney. That's a huge item, and I definitely want to get into that. But I also want to talk about the new 52 a year later. And I'm working on getting a group of about four people together, including myself and Corey, to really talk through that and get our feelings on where we're at, and especially what they're doing. So it's something I definitely want to try out, and I'm going to give it a little bit of a different format next time. So hopefully I can get that together pretty quickly and get that out. If not, I think Corey and I will definitely put it together another episode within the next week or two, especially talking about LucasArts and what that's going to bring, especially with the announcement of a new Star Wars in 2015. That's right around the corner, guys. It's less than 3 years away, to be perfectly honest, unless they really go late 2015. But the advantage of that is that's always been kind of destined, so... we hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you around next time. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and tell us how we're doing. Until next time, have a good night.